Please be seated.
Good morning. It's good to have a break yesterday and to read that evidence quietly. And so thank you very much for that evidence, and including Ms. McIntyre's, which has come through, and including the updated position from IRAG. That was helpful as well. So I think we're in your hands. Unless anybody wants me to address anything, I think we're in Mr. Moore's hands. Here you do. Oh, yep.
Yes,
saw that.
For ORUG, just in relation to Mr. Hickey, and I just wanted to draw your attention to that and formally seek leave.
No, saw that. You want to cross-examine Mr. Hickey, that's fine, and I have let Mr. Cooper know as well, so I think that's all accommodated now in the schedule, and I can well understand in terms of the theory of your case why that is actually important that you do so. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, ma'am.
Right.
Thanks, Your Honour. I think we indicated on Tuesday that we're keen to cross-examine Mr. Te Pausmaker this morning, but it got left off the timetable.
Did it?
Yes.
Sorry. Instantaneously, Mr. Cooper's
right.
Sitting there smiling. You're back in there.
I gave him a heads up. We're still interested in doing it unless everyone else covers off what we want to ask.
Okay, yeah. There's just so much going on in a proceeding like that. It's actually kind of helpful just to put that in writing, you know, even if it is an email and not a formal memorandum, so that we've got eyes on it somewhere within the system. So, but no, you're on, and there's a particular order to things which Mr. Cooper knows, and he will tell you when you are on, quite literally. Yeah.
Great.
So just confer with him in terms of the impact on the schedule.
Great.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes, finally, Mr. Moore.
Thank you. As signalled on Wednesday, mm-hmm. I've lost track of days, the last time, Tuesday.
Yep.
Tuesday.
You've got some submission.
I have some legal submissions, yep. So I'll hand those up. Thank you. The court's invited counsel to make legal submissions on the implications of Clause 1.7 of the NPS and its relevance to Plan Change 7. Clause 1.7 requires certain changes to be made to regional policy statements and regional plans without using a process in Schedule 1 of the Act. I've set out my paragraph 2, Clause 1.7, mm-hmm. and I've set out Section 55 of the Act as well.
Just reread those.
So I say, importantly, Section 55 draws a distinction between a plan and a proposed plan, amongst other things. Mm-hmm. A proposed plan includes a change to a plan proposed by a local authority that has been notified under Clause 5 of Schedule 1. I picked up there the definition from Section 43, capital A, capital A, capital C.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but we've got to the point that this looks like the Income Tax Act.
Yes, it is looking a little that way. I always struggle with the letters and not the numbers on sections. That perhaps gives an indication as to the need for some refreshment of the legislation. So I say it anticipates, this is Section 55, it anticipates that there may be a range of documents that might be the subject of a direction under Section 55, subsection 2, capital A, and that any such direction will prescribe the document or documents to be changed. Section 55(2), capital D, deals with the timeframes within which changes must be made. In relation to the changes required by clause 1.7, the relevant section is section 2, capital D, subsection or subparagraph A. Mm-hmm. That is, the local authority must make the amendments as soon as practicable. Now, the word practicable is not defined in the NPS, so I've set out some relevant dictionary definitions below, and you'll see there that there is some consistency in terms of those definitions. Mm-hmm. And then the final requirement is that the local authority must give public notice of the amendments within 5 working days after making them. So I then address fish passage, and I deal with that first because that requires the text to be inserted as an objective, and I've set out the relevant clause. Mm-hmm. The key observations I make are that the requirement is expressed as an objective. It must be included in a regional plan, and I've footnoted there the definition of a regional plan as meaning an operative plan. And therefore I submit that the clause does not require that the objective be inserted into a proposed plan or a change to a plan. If that was the intention, I submit that clause 326(1) would have included a proposed plan in the chapeau after regional plan. Therefore, the council is required to insert the text from clause 3.261 into its operative regional plan or plans as an objective without following the process in Schedule 1 of the Act as soon as is practicable, and must then give public notice within 5 working days of having done so. And importantly, in the context of Plan Change 7, the council is not required, and I submit must not, insert this objective into Plan Change 7 without following the Schedule 1 process.
Now, in relation to fish passage or anything else, the other two provisions that you mention, I take it that the Regional Council has not given public notice as to the insertion of those provisions?
That is correct, and I come on to address what's happening with them further on in the submissions, but yes, that is correct. So I step through next clause 3.22, which deals with the policy to be inserted in relation to natural inland wetlands, and I've set that out in full. And I've also set out clause 3.24 and the relevant part there in relation to rivers. So in relation to those two clauses, I submit that the requirements, they are expressed as policies. Again, they must be included in an operative regional plan or plans, and that the relevant clauses do not require that the policies be inserted into a proposed plan or a change to a plan. So therefore, the council is required to insert the text from clauses 3.221 and 3.241 into its operative regional plan as policies without following the process in Schedule 1 of the Act as soon as is practicable, and again must give public notice within 5 working days. Again, like the fish passage objective, I submit that the Council is not required to insert these policies into Plan Change 7 without following the Schedule 1 process. As to timing, as I set out in my paragraph 6, the Council is required to make the amendments to its operative regional plan as soon as practicable. The Council has not yet made these amendments to its operative planning framework, but intends to do so in the very near future.
So not merely a matter to be held over for a future land and water plan, it will, as far as you understand the Council's intentions.
Yes.
Seek to amend its operative plan by bringing forward this objective and the two policies.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
And you see that, and you will no doubt have seen that happening with other policies that had to be inserted previously. It's a little bit clunky about how they fit within an operative plan.
Yeah.
And councils have different ways of doing that, and they put them in different places, but they do get brought down and dropped in what is considered to be the most convenient place within the planning framework so that they are part of that operative planning framework.
Can you give me an example of where it has been done by a regional council?
There were some examples in the Canterbury framework when the 2014 iteration of the NPSFM came to bear, and those changes from recollection were inserted at simply with a fresh page at the beginning of the plan, is my recollection. I've also seen plans in the Southland one, is the one I have in mind, where provisions were inserted at what looked like a more obvious place to put it. And I'm thinking, for example, of the policy, and it might have been B6, the one dealing with water quantity, and that was put into the part of the plan that had some policies dealing with water quantity. But it's often dropped in and put into a shaded grey box with a footnote saying this was inserted pursuant to whichever clause and whichever NPS without following the Schedule 1 process. And the plan simply gets updated at that point in time and typically resealed again.
As a matter of interest, with Southland, are you talking about the proposed plan there or something else?
I'm thinking more of the operative framework.
Okay. And then the second question is this. It's all very well to insert an objective or a policy, but did those councils, as in the Canterbury example, then also go on to insert, if it was an objective, you know, underlying or responding policies and rules?
No.
Oh, so how did that work?
It's clunky because you don't have the machinery to implement the policies.
Right.
They become relevant considerations on discretionary and non-complying applications, and depending on the wording of the policy, it may be relevant to a matter of control or discretion. So it's picked up somewhat uncomfortably, just depending on what the plan, the operative plan, actually says. So to give those an objective and policies full colour, councils often have to then go through a further planning process, which then can pick up some machinery in terms of matters of control or discretion or further rules to deal with the issues.
So to the extent that they can be picked up will be where you're looking for a fully discretionary or a non-complying activity, and then they can at least be relevant in that context.
Yes, and it also depends a little bit on the wording of the policy, and my recollection was one of those 2014 policies, may have even been the 2011 version, was about discharges, so it was an extra policy that had to be considered in relation to all discharges.
Yeah.
So again, it's dependent on the wording.
And what you also... And the other content of the plan.
Yes, as to whether there's actually a hook for consideration.
Okay, now that's really helpful. Thank you.
So in terms of the relevance to Plan Change 7, it's submitted that the council was not required to insert the fish passage objective and the wetlands policy or the rivers policy into Plan Change 7, and that is because it's a proposed change to a planning document. However, I go on to say that the obligations under the NPSFM are ongoing. As such, once Plan Change 7 is made operative, the Council will have to insert those provisions into it, or at least include a cross-reference to those provisions in terms of where they might have landed in the operative plan. The reason that will need to occur is because Chapter 10A is drafted as a standalone code and does not reference any of the other objectives in the regional plan water. If and when that occurs, the fish passage objective and the wetlands and rivers policies will be relevant matters when considering an application for a non-complying activity, and I make that submission based on the 14 March version because there aren't any matters of control or discretion that are picking up those policies and the objective. And I say, therefore, they will not be relevant considerations with respect to the proposed controlled activity or the proposed restricted discretionary activity, assuming they stay in that form. So they will in time come down, but they're not a relevant matter for this court to implement.
No, I know what you're saying.
So,
all right.
So those are my submissions on
that. That's helpful. Any comment about DOC submissions on this point? Or do you want to leave that for your reply?
I think I might. My friend... my recollection was my friend's submission was that they come down and they come down straight away. I may have misheard that, but insofar as that was her submission, I'd take a different view for the reasons that I've outlined in these submissions.
Okay.
But I appreciate I've probably had a little more time to pick through the definitions than my friend may have had.
Okay, all right, so we'll leave that for your reply.
Yes.
Because I think this issue is going to fish passage is it, going to be
precisely.
Truly important for a number of parties.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes,
thank you very much. That was really helpful.
Very good. Well, we move now to the supplementary evidence that was filed by the council on Sunday of last week.
Yep.
And the first witness I'll call or have recalled is Mr. De Pelsmaker.
And we were going to hear the questions on cross-examination. We didn't want to clear the pitch by hearing from us first on that. So we'll go straight to questions of cross-examination. And I just had to check with my colleagues whether they had anything for Mr. Wilson, because if we don't, we might just... Because I don't think anybody else does.
No, in my understanding, Mr. Welsh was probably the only one who might, and I don't think he did have any.
He wouldn't dare.
I was just going to say we might end up with a supplementary brief from Mr. Wilson if I did, ma'am. So no, I don't have any need. I've explained how the confusion arose, and I don't need to put that back to Mr. Wilson at all, ma'am.
That's good. Questions for Wilson? Questions. So how do you want to? We've no questions for Mr. Wilson. So how do you want to deal with his brief?
If that could be admitted by consent, we won't need to have him recalled to swear.
Yep.
So if there's no objection to that.
No objection to that. So we'll admit Mr. Wilson's supplementary evidence. Just get the date. Which is the one I haven't got exactly with me. What date is it?
It's dated the 14th of March.
Supplementary evidence dated the 14th of March will be admitted by consent with the court to read and place what weight it decides is appropriate on the same. All right, thank you.
It's going to please us. Your Honour, I had considered whether it might be of assistance to lead Mr. De Pelsmaker through his supplementary evidence, but given that parties have actually had a little more time to consider it, I'm happy to proceed straight to questions, unless the court would be better assisted by...
I don't think we would. We've already we read it. As I said, we were actually grateful to have that break as well in the proceedings to consider the same, so we're happy to move straight on.
Very good. Have you confirmed that your... full name is Tom Willie De Pelsmaker.
I do.
And you've set out your qualifications and experience in a statement of evidence in chief dated 7 December 2020.
I have.
And you've prepared some supplementary evidence dated 14 March 2021.
That is correct.
Any corrections that you wish to make to that statement?
Not to the statement itself. However, I would like to make a correction to the appendices. If you go to Appendix 1 and 2, where I refer to policy 10A23, the amended policy reads, irrespective of any other policies in this plan concerning consent duration, resource consents that replace deemed permits or resource consents that replace water permits to take and or use surface water, including groundwater considered as surface water, under policy 641A, A, B, and C of this plan, where those water permits expire prior to the 31st of December 2025 for a duration of no more than 6 years, the no should be deleted in the last line. And that is both in appendix.
I don't have a no. And you avoided saying avoid granting, so which I did have. So, hold on, just see if it's in the other one. Oh, for a duration of no more than 6 years?
Yes.
Want to say... Okay, so I thought the word no came after that. So for a duration of what?
More than 6 years.
More than 6 years. And you can confirm that the second line of the policy in both iterations of your appendices 1 and 2, the second line contains the word avoid granting. So irrespective of any other policies in this plan concerning consent duration, avoid granting is how it reads.
That is correct. Okay. My apologies for that.
No, I didn't hear it. Maybe you said it, but I didn't hear it.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I did not.
Very good.
Subject to those corrections, do you confirm that your supplementary evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Now, in relation to your supplementary evidence, there were a number of paragraphs where the wording notes that the council proposes some amendments. Mm-hmm. Are you able to confirm that where you've used those words, that is your opinion in relation to the changes being recommended?
Yes, that is my opinion. Yeah.
Thank you. If you could please remain for any questions from my friends and any questions from the court.
Yes.
Mr. Winchester.
Sorry, Mum, I'm here for Mr. Winchester today.
I know you're not.
Sorry. My eyes were on something else, obviously. Sorry about that, Ms. Lennon.
No worries. Good morning, Mr. De Pelsmaker.
Good morning.
I have a couple of quick questions for you in relation to Ms. McIntyre's supplementary statement, which was filed yesterday.
Yes.
Have you got that in front of you?
I do now.
So you'll see at paragraph 7 that Ms. McIntyre has recommended one amendment to your updated provisions. And she's included some additional words at the front end of policy 10A.2.3. Have you got that?
Yes, I have.
Do you accept these amendments?
I've given this some consideration yesterday and overnight, and I do not have an issue with those amendments. I do think that it might be worthwhile to, because essentially the proposed amendment reflects what is in the objective to a certain degree, and it might be worthwhile aligning the wording of the objective and the proposed amendment
yes.
a bit more with each other, but otherwise I don't have an issue with it.
Thank you, Mr. De Pelsmaker. That was all my questions.
All right, thank you. Ms. Dixon.
Good morning.
I want to start just by walking through with you the way in which the new non-compliant policy and rule will work.
Yes.
Partly to ensure that we all understand it. And also because I want to query you about it as well. So let's start with my understanding of what will happen when an application is filed that is for a period of more than 6 years. It will need to be under the non-complying rule as a non-complying category?
That is correct, because it does not meet entry condition I of, or the first entry condition of the controlled activity rule.
Right. Great. So that will bring an applicant under policy 10A3.2, and the consent application will be processed as a non-complying activity. Now, to go through a non-complying activity gateway, there are two gateways that are offered under Section 104D of the RMA, aren't there?
That is correct.
So you must either be... the effects of the activity must be minor adverse effects, or the application can't be contrary to the policies and objectives.
That is correct.
So in this particular case, any applicant is going to have to rely on getting through the minor adverse effects gateway, aren't they? Because the policy is in fact going to prevent going through the gateway regarding policies and objectives?
That is one way. If you want to go through the gateway of policy, under section 104D1B, it would be very hard. But my understanding as well is that under that test, you need to consider the objectives and the policies together as a whole. It would be very hard because you would be contrary to the policies that restrict duration. Thought about it hard and discussed it as well with people in the consents team. It would be the only exception where I think people would get through is where they clearly meet the objective and where it actually facilitates a quick transition or more quickly transition towards the implementation of a freshwater regime. But I admit that the restriction on the consent duration policy now is a very big hurdle.
Can we put the objective to one side for a moment? Because mm-hmm. I would like to come back to that.
Yes.
Let's just stick with the policy, which, as you've clarified this morning, effectively reads, avoid granting for a duration of more than 6 years.
That is correct.
Take out all the stuff in between that clarifies what it relates to. So avoid granting for a duration of more than 6 years. And we know... Well, I think we're all now very familiar with the case law that's followed from King Salmon that avoid basically means you can't do something.
Yes.
So you described it as a hard policy. I'd say that effectively that gateway is closed because of the way this policy has now been framed. Would you accept that?
I find it very hard to imagine an example where people would get through. I accept that, yes.
I agree. So, to get through the gateway, I think we're by and large agreed that you would need to have an application with minor adverse effects. So let's imagine the activity has made it through that particular gateway. And now the application comes to be assessed under section 104.1b.6. Do we need to go to the Act to look at that? But it's essentially the provision in that particular section of part of section 104 that requires you to go back and look at the policies again.
The policies, but my understanding is as well you take into account other planning, higher order planning documents such as the RPS.
True.
And the where you can have regard to those NPSs as well.
True, but the particular provision that I'm looking at, Roman numeral 6, refers to the relevant provisions of a plan. Mm-hmm. And the relevant provisions of the plan in this case, again, take us back to
correct.
The objective and the policies. So the point that I would put you is that, in fact, this application is going to fail, this particular test, again, because of the wording of this policy. Avoid granting for more than 6 years. Do you agree with that?
The intent is definitely to reduce the opportunities for people to apply for longer-term consent under the original proposed non-complying rule. Mm-hmm. The discussions and the questioning last week in court, as well as some of the evidence presented, showed that actually, rather than it being an exemption, it's becoming a bit of a target. Mm-hmm. So that's the intent behind it, is to get as many people, give as many consents, or grant as many consents as possible for a 6-year term.
I understand that, and I appreciate that your revised approach to the non-complying rule is in response to the questioning and the submissions that you've heard, and I appreciate that. I'm just trying at this stage to understand exactly what this will mean, the way the rule has been revised. And my suggestion to you is that, in fact, because of the combination of the way in which the tests under Section 104D work and then the assessment that's required under Section 104.1B, Roman numeral 6, no activity, in fact, is going to get a consent for more than 6 years under this plan change.
That is possible.
I think it's more than possible. That's the effect of the very strong policy that's been drafted. And my point to you is really that what that means is that there are no true exceptions that have now been provided for, are there?
Yes.
And there is no provision for that matters that are recognised by the national policy statements that we've earlier discussed, the MPSREG, or specifically for drinking water.
That is correct.
And we have agreed earlier, I think, that the national policy statements must be given effect to in a regional plan.
That is correct.
Thank you. Let's come back to the question of the objective that you raised just a moment ago, because we've discussed how the policy has definitely been strengthened. Very much strengthened, and you referred to the fact that a decision maker would also look back to the objective in PC 7. So let's have a look at the objective in PC 7. If we could do that, please. And it begins, and with the changes that have been made, essentially it's still the same, isn't it? Transition towards the long-term sustainable management of fresh water in the Otago region by establishing this, et cetera, and so it goes on. What I wanted to put to you is actually that this doesn't provide any guidance to a decision maker. It's simply a process, a procedural objective.
It points towards an outcome, a procedural outcome.
But that outcome is just a transition. It's not actually an outcome in terms of something that this transition is intended to achieve. Would that be fair?
Perhaps, yes. Yep.
Okay. And I just want to put to you a couple of decisions which have commented, resource consent decisions, which have in fact commented on, Your Honour, I can just pass them mm-hmm. to the witness, if that would be
Are these resource consents from Otago?
Yes. The decisions I've just given Mr. De Pilsmaker are decisions made by Otago Regional Council applying the objective and the provisions of PC7. So they're resource consent decisions. I'm actually suggesting to Mr. Mr. Ensor, as part of the supplementary brief that he's filing later today, that he attaches them to his evidence
so
we can get them into the court that way,
sure.
Rather than making up exhibits or something at this point.
Are you familiar with those two decisions?
I'm not familiar with
those. Okay, so how do you want to go with this? How do you want to proceed? Do you want to give them time to read and come back to the question?
Probably I only need to take you to one paragraph, which is actually only one line. Line and one paragraph in the decision. The two decisions that I've just given Mr. De Pelsmaker are Rockburn Wines Limited,
yes.
And the second one is Pisa Holdings and others.
Mm-hmm.
6th of October 2020 for Rockburn Wines. And Mr. De Pilsmaker, would you mind telling me what the decision is for the other one? Because in my muddle in front of me, I've mislaid my own copy of that decision.
They're both 6th of October.
Both the same date?
Yes.
Right. Well, let's just deal with Rockburn Wines. First off, if I could take you to paragraph 97 of the Rockburn Wines decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a really narrow point that I was making. Can you please read paragraph 97 to the court?
PPC 7, objective 10A11, is procedural only.
Thank you. So the point that I was making is that, in fact, the way the objective is framed at the moment is not actually providing decision makers with any particular assistance in terms of the way in which they're applying the objective in the course of actually making a decision. And this is a decision maker making that observation in the context of a decision. From Rockburn Wines. You accept that that's what's happening?
Yes. Yep.
And I suppose, just to close the loop, in essentials, the objective as notified and as now proposed has not changed in that respect, because, of course, it was the notified objective that the decision maker was applying.
Yep.
So that's correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. All right. The final point that I wanted to discuss with you, Mr. De Pelsmaker, is this slightly vexed questions of the deemed priorities.
Yep.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion in the court about Galaxids.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure when we hear the case from Fish and Game, there'll be more in the context of trout and galaxids and how they interrelate in the particular waterways and so on. We need to start from an assumption that the priorities are currently being exercised, and I understand that is a question that is out there, but let's assume for the moment that priorities are being exercised and observed. I presume it would be your understanding that the deemed priorities do have a role in shielding the galaxid populations, because galaxids thrive where trout don't, and the different flow patterns under the deemed permits and the priorities associated with those have, at least in some circumstances, created the ecological circumstances, to use a very layman's kind of approach to it, that have allowed these, the sort of ecological hotspots where the trout can't get at the galaxids. Is that your understanding of the scientific evidence we've got?
I accept that, yes. Yep.
Now, we've talked quite a lot earlier on, and there's been some discussion in the court about the resolutions that were passed at the Extraordinary Council meeting of the 27th of November 2019,
yep.
Which you have quoted in your supplementary evidence again, one of which was the existing priorities and the deemed permits. That's at paragraph 5C.
Yes.
So in your supplementary, you've talked about the extraordinary meeting at paragraph 5, set out again the principles that the plan change was to follow, and at C, one of those is existing priorities and deemed permits. Yes?
That's correct.
Really just want to say to you, would you accept that, given the point you've accepted about the relationship between the deemed permits and, to some extent at least, the protection of the galaxids, would you accept that that's the point of connection between the principles that Council identified and which, as I discussed in my submissions, were reflected back to the Minister, and then the Minister's direction for call-in that was also being looked at earlier in the hearing, in terms of matters of national significance, regional significance, etc., where the galaxids are identified?
These are assumptions.
It's all based on that assumption.
It is assumptions. I was not party to any of those discussions that might have led to using that terminology.
It's a point of connection.
Yeah, it could be. It could well be. The point around priorities is still very much alive here in the court, and also we've been thinking about it as well. We have looked at a number of deemed permits, and as you will see as well in the annexes that were provided to the court, there are a number of examples where the priorities are either stated as a note, but then in other examples, the priorities on the deemed permit are stated as a condition. So there is, at some point in time, when the mining privileges were converted into deemed permits, there is some inconsistency as to how those priorities were carried over into the deemed permits. One of the things I mentioned before, where a priority system is in place, to a degree it will be reflected in the limits determined through the schedule, but also with the amended or the recommended amendments that we've provided to the court on Sunday, we now have a new proposed matter of control, C, which states any other conditions on the existing permit to be replaced where those matters are not otherwise addressed by the entry of conditions of this rule or matters of discretion. Sorry, but that's for the controlled, that's for the restricted discretionary activity. Mm-hmm. But we also have a matter of control for the controlled activity rule. That expresses the same. Again, matter of control C, any other conditions on the expiring permit to be replaced where those matters are not otherwise addressed by the entry conditions of this rule or matter of control. So where priorities are put as a condition on a deemed permit, this allows you to carry it over.
Yeah.
So it is... another tool in the toolbox to continue priorities as a condition on the replacement consent in cases where they are currently a condition and where they would be exercised.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And I'm sure that my friend on my left here will want to explore the actual operation of that with you.
Yeah.
My point really was just to say that it's around the galaxids and the scientific evidence that we've heard on the galactics that we can connect the matter of significance that the Minister identified in the direction to call in and the way in which Council was anticipating that deemed priorities might be dealt with. It's a much narrower point.
Yeah, yes, I know. Sorry, I might have gone a bit further. But I guess what I was saying is still very much alive and we're trying to explore how we can deal with it. But as you heard as well, there is a lot of uncertainty in the room as to, where are they still being observed?
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. DePaul.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Ms. Williams.
Mr. DePelsenmaker, I'm going to start with the objective. So this is the revised objective that you have, and I noted with interest your answer to my friend Ms. Lennon before when commenting on Ms. McIntyre's supplementary brief. Ms. McIntyre had suggested some changes to the policy, and you stated in answer to Ms. Lennon that you thought that perhaps that also should be carried up into the objective?
Both kind of point towards the same outcome, but they use a slightly different terminology. The objective points towards a long-term sustainable management framework, whereas from recollection, the amendment proposed by Ms. McIntyre specifically refers to an NPSFM compliant regime.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
The objective is framed currently just says transition toward, but this particular plan change itself is not the transition, is it? It's something you've used in your answers, words like facilitating and enabling. Mm-hmm. And would it not be better to start the objective with something like that, enabling the transition toward or facilitating the transition toward? Because that's actually what this plan change is doing, isn't it?
It is, correct.
And you accept that perhaps enabling or facilitating something like that would be clearer about the purpose of this objective?
Yeah, accepted, yes.
Okay, thank you. You will have heard Mr. Moore's legal submissions this morning on the NPSFM and the fish passage objective and the rivers and natural and wetlands policies. And as I understood Mr. Moore, the effect of his submissions is that they're not matters that the court needs to consider now, but they are matters that will need to, once Plan Change 7 is operative, be implemented and given effect to within the plan change. And with some questions about how that is done, but they will be there. Given that that is the case, I understand from Mr. Moore's submissions that they would only apply to the non-complying activity. Is that what you understood?
Correct.
And so they would not apply to the controlled activity or the restricted discretionary activity?
Correct.
An objective is something that's seeking an outcome, the National Policy Statement, fish passage objective. Fish passage is expressed as an objective. So that's essentially something that's quite important to be thinking about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it may be that even within a six-year period, it would still be relevant and appropriate to allow a matter of control to manage fish passage. Knowing that there's going to be an objective to support that to come.
With the controlled activity rule, with the redraft actually of the proposed plan change, it was intended to kind of bring it back towards the procedural outcome, especially with the controlled activity rule providing for a cost-effective process. The fish passage, including that as a matter of control or a matter of discretion in the proposed rule framework, after hearing the evidence of Mr. Dunn as well, I was not very clear as to what the implications of that would be in terms of achieving that outcome. Also, as Mr. Moore was explaining as well, the NPSFM does not require us to do it immediately. It's as soon as practicable. That doesn't mean that council should drag its tail, but given that it's a transitional framework, it might be more appropriate, in my opinion, to leave fish passage as a requirement out of the controlled activity rule.
And this, is, in part, is based on your expectation that because this would roll over existing provisions, existing takes, that the fish passage, whatever the current situation is, will be maintained.
Yes, and if there is a certain condition on a consent, again, this can be carried over.
Yep.
Yep.
I was interested to see in your supplementary evidence, and I'm sorry, I've just got to find the right... At para 23 and 24, that you would, in relation to minimum flows, residual flows, or take cessation conditions, that those are now coming out as a matter of control. And I'm just talking to the controlled activity rule. And that... and then you go on to say that you don't propose to include existing priorities as a matter of control where they are not currently a condition. But as I understood the discussion that you've just had with Ms. Dixon, where priorities are currently a condition, your new matter of control C would allow for that condition
it
to
does,
be carried
yes.
over.
Yeah.
And I think you would accept that a... exercise of a priority is very similar to a take cessation condition?
Could be, yes. Yeah.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Thank you. Mr. Welsh?
No, I'm not on the list.
Yes, you are.
Oh, good. no, you are on the list. Sorry. Obviously not reading this well today. All the room. But I know you are, Miss Baker Galloway, so you are next.
Thank you, Mum. Right. Good morning. So I'm probably just to keep the theme on the fish passage matter of control, which in the controlled in the RD draft is now struck out. Mm-hmm. And again, just looking explicitly at clause 3.26 of the NPSFM. I think Ms. Williams got you there, but I just wanted to be clear that your opinion, if the 14 March drafting of the matters of control and discretion excludes fish passage,
correct,
but rolls over all of the existing operational requirements of the deemed permits.
Yes, or if it's a consent, and it would have an existing condition relating to fish passage, it could be rolled over as well. Yeah.
So in that scenario, the status quo of fish passage is maintained, isn't it? Whatever the status quo of fish passage.
Against the initial or original consent.
Yes.
Yes, correct.
So in that sense, it is consistent with provision 3.26, which requires that fish passage is maintained or improved. They're alternatives, aren't they?
Maintained.
Yes, so they are maintained.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So there's not a requirement in provision 3.26 to improve fish passage as an absolute.
I have to look at it again. Sorry.
Yep, no, by all means, yep, have a look. So if you can get the NPS. Because I'll let you get it and have a read.
I had it somewhere. Sorry, I'm getting lost in my paperwork. Got it. Yep. Yes, I've got the relevant provision.
Right. Yep. So I'll put the question again. The 14 March controlled and restricted discretionary rules will maintain the current status of fish passage, won't they?
That is correct.
And that is consistent with policy 3.261 of the NPS, isn't it?
Correct.
And if a consent is considered under the non-complying framework, council, the decision maker, will have the ability in that context to consider whether there needs to be improvement of fish passage for any reason.
That is correct.
Including protection of fish species from other species that might predate or compete.
That is correct. My understanding is that under the non-complying activity rule, if you pass the gateways, you can consider the NPSFM and therefore this objective. And also, as Mr. Mal pointed out, we've committed to inserting it into initially the operative water plan and then either through cross-referencing or stating the objective explicitly into Plan Change 7.
Cool. And so by taking the fish passage matter of control out of those controlled and restricted discretionary rules, it's removing another area of potential cost for applicants and council, isn't it?
Correct.
In terms of the technical assessments that might be required to improve fish passage?
Correct.
And it's removing uncertainty for applicants for the same reasons?
Correct.
And it's bringing that rule more and more back to that purely procedural rollover of the status quo, isn't it?
Correct.
Now I'd like to jump up to the entry points of the controlled activity rule, entry point conditions. And would like to focus primarily or initially on rule condition Roman numeral 3, mm-hmm. where you're still retaining, proposing to retain the entry point that the maximum area irrigated not be increased?
Correct.
And what I'm actually wanting to test is how the what you view as the necessity and the reasons for keeping that as an entry point. And it's all on the same theme of fine-tuning this rule to its pure, you know, base procedural requirements. So is one of the reasons for keeping the irrigation entry point in these rules a concern in respect of additional investment in infrastructure? I'll ask it one step at a time. Additional investment in infrastructure, is that one of the concerns that leads
to... One of the concerns, yep.
And is another reason the increased or possible increased dependence on maximum abstraction being continued to be used?
Sorry, can you explain a little bit?
Yeah, I'll try and rephrase that. Well, based on what you know about the importance of reliability of supply, mm-hmm. when an irrigated area is increased and all of the investment in infrastructure still requires that high level of security of supply and reliability, is one of the reasons... this rule precludes that is because it's then again harder for an abstractor to adapt to less reliability of supply and less water.
That is correct. My understanding, I'm not an expert in irrigation, but my understanding is expansions often entail a change in irrigation practice and more efficient systems are also more dependent on a higher reliability of supply.
Okay. And there's a third reason of holding the line in terms of irrigated area, anything to do with water quality and leaching of nutrients or not?
The potential for that to exist, yes.
Okay. So if an irrigator chose to proceed down the non-complying route primarily because they breached this one entry point, mm-hmm. they wanted to increase their area of irrigation, at the moment in terms of getting any direction in the policies about the implications of that specific breach, would you look at policy 10A21?
Yes, you would look at that. Yes.
And obviously 10A23 also.
Yes.
Okay, moving on to entry point 4, Roman numeral 4, in the controlled activity rule, which if I put it in my terms, is effectively removal of paper allocation, of unused paper allocation.
Correct.
And actually what I want to do is compare that as an explicit entry point with Mr. Ensor's drafting of this rule for the Minister. So if you can find Mr. Ensor's evidence in chief, and I accept it, it may be changing, I'm not sure, but at least I want to understand what you think of that comparison.
Yes.
So we're looking at controlled activity rule 10A 3.1.1, Roman numerals 4, and Ensor.
Roman numeral 2 is Mr. Ensor's equivalent, I think. That's what I'm trying to compare it with.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So Mr. Ensor has sort of consolidated, if you like, the entry points, that might be an inelegant way of putting it, into a Roman numeral number 2. And when you read his wording the proposed take is the direct replacement or otherwise reduces the volume of water taken of a deemed permit, dot, dot, dot. Is your interpretation of that as an entry point that it doesn't explicitly require the surrendering of the unused paper allocation?
That's correct.
And do you agree that it's important for this plan change and to achieve its objective to be explicit and very certain about that?
That's correct. It's one of the principles behind the plan change and it's a mechanism that's already in the plan. And I believe I actually stated that in my evidence in reply as well, that the proposal of Mr. Ensor, while I kind of agree with the general intent, but it would have the effect that you wouldn't eliminate paper allocation.
Thank you. Now, just one, if you've got Mr. Farrell's evidence handy. Or if you haven't, that's probably okay if it's going to be a drama.
Don't have it.
So if you go to his appendix and look at the controlled activity rule, and then also the non-complying rule, and in terms of the clauses B on both of those rules, he's highlighted with a comment box that the terminology, the wording, when describing what's either currently authorised as the wording used in the controlled rule, mm-hmm. or that is a replacement take, is the wording used in the non-complying rule. Is there any magic in the different drafting there, or when we get to a mop-up, would those two clauses be consistent?
There is no material difference. So when it comes to further refining the drafting, I think there's an opportunity to kind of align that better. My initial response would that the controlled activity, the wording in the controlled activity rule is probably more concise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, thank you. That's clear. And then my final questions are about the non-complying policy, 10A23. And as you'll be aware, part of Fish and Game's case is that it would be of assistance to have a direction in the policies as to what more than minor is. And whilst Fish and Game is supportive of your redrafting, because it is, I think, even clearer and more directive, if an applicant goes down the alternative gateway through Section 104D, 1A, I think, and still has to assess itself under that no more than minor test, do you think it would be of assistance if there's a separate policy direction in the plan that informs that assessment under the alternative non-complying gateway?
I think we discussed it previously as well last week. I have a little bit of concerns about it. I had some concerns about the wording. There was a little bit of unclarity in the wording. But also, there are a few other risks. Firstly, the thresholds proposed, they reflect to a degree of hydrological alteration, and they link it to ecological values as well. I think it was used to species of conservation concerns. But actually, there are only two aspects that you would consider when you look at what are appropriate flow regimes, and there might be others that are not included in that. The other concern is that it could work in two ways. In a lot of areas in Otago, simply works as a prohibition almost, because you wouldn't pass the test because the thresholds are so stringent.
But in others... Is it the intent?
No, that's not the intent. But in other... Sorry, the intent of...
Making it as difficult as possible to get a consent that's not a six-year consent in the controlled activity.
That is the intent of the controlled activity, yeah. Yeah. But in other areas where there is allocation available potentially, it could become a target as well. And we still want to keep people to a six-year consent. So hence my reluctance for those two reasons, really.
And the other possible benefit, I know you're not agreeing with me, but I'm going to put to you the other proposition as well. The other benefit of having a clear direction as to what is considered more than minor on the face of it is that would also inform the decision about whether or not an application needed to be publicly notified. Do you think that would be helpful?
It would probably assist consent officers in making that assessment.
Yeah. Thank you, ma'am. No further questions.
Cool. Forrest and Bird, are you going next?
Yep.
Thank you. So I guess we've established this morning that the whole intent of this is to limit consent duration to no more than 6 years, is that?
That's correct, yes.
Correct. Thank you. And do you think it's accurate to describe the rules that you've set out as reasonably permissible? It's not necessarily a high bar for applicants to go through either the controlled activity or the restricted discretionary?
The controlled activity and the restricted discretionary activity pathway are definitely more lenient than the non-complying one.
Yeah, because essentially existing users would just need to be able to demonstrate their existing use through that methodology or some other way if they can't demonstrate it through that methodology, and essentially applications would be approved. That's my understanding of.
That is a large part of it, but they also need to show they also need to meet the other entry conditions. Mm-hmm. Relating to existing conditions in their application around minimum flows. So that needs to be included in their application, as well as no increase in irrigated area.
Sure, sure. But in terms of preparing these applications, it's not a comprehensive assessment that's required for it, is it?
No, and that's deliberate.
That's deliberate, yeah. And that would be regardless of what they intend to use that water for. This is agnostic to end use, if it's irrigation, hydro, community takes, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. And do you think 6 years is a reasonable amount of time for someone to prepare a more comprehensive application for a future, more potentially more stringent MPS compliant consent?
In a way, I believe that because the current plan, it repeats a lot of the language in the current plan repeats what's in the RMA. There are a lot of, for example, around efficiency as well. The wording of those policies are very vague. There's no clear standards. I would actually anticipate that under the new land and water plan, more certainty is provided, and it would actually make it easier to prepare an application under that plan compared to under the current plan.
Sure. Yeah. And we've talked this morning about the non-complying is a very large stick, isn't it? It's quite difficult for people to meet that test if they wanted a consent duration longer than 6 years.
Correct.
Can you think of an example of where an applicant may want to go down this path?
An example where an applicant would want to go down the path, or where we would grant a consent?
I think both. I was going to come to the second, but you can cover both.
I can. I think quite a few people will probably look. I'm speculating now, but will probably look at exploring the option, the non-complying pathway option, to achieve a longer-term consent. As I said before, I really struggled to find an example where we would grant a longer-term consent. Yeah.
Do you think it's fair on applicants for the council to have put in place its plan this option that has a very low bar of success, and people could put significant effort into an application to try and overcome these tests, which, as we've established, is a very high bar?
Which test is the high bar?
Sorry, the non-compliant pathway.
The non-compliant pathway. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
So, Corey, could you repeat that?
So, under we've established that a non-compliant pathway is a high bar.
Yes.
And part of the purpose of this plan change is to lessen the burden on applicants and the council for them entering other parties and processing these consents. And I guess retaining that non-compliant pathway presents an option that applicants may want to choose and may put significant effort into their applications. But from what you're saying, it's a very minimal chance of success. So I guess I'm just wondering, is that a fair proposition to still enable that?
Well, I think the wording in the policy is now sufficiently clear, and it should act as a deterrent for people to explore that avenue and instead just focus on a control activity rule.
Do you think it would be much more clearer for applicants and everyone involved if that was more simply just a prohibited activity rule?
As I said, there might be situations where you would allow for slightly longer time frame if it serves the purpose, if it serves the overall objective of moving more quickly towards a long-term sustainable management regime. I've tried to think of some examples. For example, if somebody has a resource consent currently that runs until 2040, he wants to change some of the parameters within that resource consent, or wants to move to a different kind of use. There you could potentially consider longer term, because if we wouldn't allow for that consent, it might actually result in that activity or that water take only coming in at a later date, if you understand what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. And in that situation, there's nothing that would prevent that this hypothetical applicant going for the controlled activity or restricted or the other pathways for an interim 6-year consent, is there? And that's not a large burden if they wanted to do that. And then they could submit a longer term consent once the new plan's in place.
But to answer your question, I think perhaps I believe that the non-complying pathway now is sufficiently strengthened, but there might be situations where people get through the gateways and get actually a slightly longer term consent, so prohibited activity might be a step too far in that regard.
Okay. Just in terms of the hydroelectricity question that's come up a few times. Is your understanding of, first of all, this Plan Change 7 is largely to do with water allocation, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. Is your understanding of the NPS, renewable energy, that it doesn't specifically talk about, like, water allocation? It's more to do with the broader benefits of renewable energy generation broadly?
Correct, but it does mention allocation, I believe, in the preamble.
Okay.
And specifically, the preamble kind of explains the relationship, I guess, between the NPS renewable energy generation and management of allocation and prioritization of fresh water under other documents of national guidance.
But it's still your opinion that there isn't, that this would be a more coherent plan change if it was, if it didn't put in place any exemptions.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. That renewable energy or any other use should be treated the same as use of water. And in your understanding, and we've established that this isn't a NPS compliant plan change, is it?
It doesn't get full
doesn't get effect. Full effect to the
no.
NPS, yeah. And the so do you think the hierarchy of the hierarchy in the NPS is relevant?
To what?
To this plan change.
Sorry, which
NPS? Sorry, the NPS freshwater, the new, the in terms of the Te Mana Aotearoa hierarchy, like we've had it suggested that renewable energy should be treated as a second order of, or it's debated whether it's a second order or third order or first order. Do you think that has much bearing in terms of the decisions that would be made under this plan as it's now focused?
Are you talking about consent decision making, or are you talking about decision making on the plan change?
I'm talking about consent decision making under the, under your now revised version of the plan change.
Under the non-complying activity pathway, like I said before, the NPSFM can have can be given regard to mm-hmm. by consent officers. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. No further questions. Thank
All right, you. Thank you. We're going to take the morning adjournment. All rise.